This is the series on the moral ecology of everyday life. Today I'm interested in looking at what I would call the complexity of clocks. And I'm going to stand because in this room it just seems silly to sit down to talk. When we go back over in the other, in the center, I'll sit back down again, but I'm going to stand for a while anyway. What I'd like to do today is to think about the way that we think about time, the way that we structure time institutionally and intellectually in American culture. I was supposed to ask if people need a sound enhancement system, and I can see that the sound enhancement system that we need here is just a louder voice. What I'd like to do before I begin, though, is to work with this diagram that Paul has put on the board here for me. And if you have a piece of paper, you might take one out and do a diagram like this for yourself. In the middle here is yourself, and then out here on the periphery of things are the different things that you do in a day. And they should be sort of assigned them to yourselves in relation to the amount of time that you put into them. So if in a normal day you spend 8 hours of your day sleeping, this large thing here ought to be sleeping because that's what you do with the time that you've got. And probably for most Americans, work consumes a very large circle of one's day, and so work ought to be that circle. And then there might be a smaller one for childcare or family time, and a maybe even smaller one for prayer, or a slightly larger one for watching TV, or some for exercise, or some for reading. The different things that you do, that's a kind of a suggestion of the things that you might think of, but try to figure out, in terms of your life, what would it look like in this sort of diagrammatic sense? Let me give you just a couple of minutes to sketch that out for yourself. These things needn't be exact, but what we're doing here is working on kind of a sketch of the way that you use your time. This is you in the middle, and these are the different things that you do in a day. This might be sleeping, working, childcare, however it works out. But do that diagram real quick, or just do it in your head if you don't have a piece of paper. Okay, now what I'd like you to do is to connect the sort of periphery of things, the things that you do, with the self in the middle. And I'd like you to make the connection in terms of the kinds of satisfactions that you get from the thing there. Okay, so if sleeping is something that gives you a tremendous amount of satisfaction, let's say this is for me, sleep. Make the lines between sleep and the self very wide. Okay? If work happens to be something where, as you'll see on the handout that I gave you, the least favorite time of Americans is Monday mornings, I think largely because it's when we go to work. If work is something that tends to be that something that you don't enjoy that much, then make the connections very small, like that. If family is something that gives you a great amount of pleasure, but you don't have a lot of time for it, then in fact your lines ought to be even larger than the circle that you've got. Okay, and then do that all the way around for the different things that you have here. This is a quick way of getting a look at the way that we use our time and the way that we feel about the way that we use our time. The way we use our time is in the circles here. The way that we feel about it is in the connections. And what you would hope you'd have in your life is a thing where the connections would be exactly the same size as the circles. That if sleep was giving you tremendous amount of, you ought to get as much satisfaction out of sleep as you put into it, you know. If you're going to sleep 12 hours, you ought to get a lot of satisfaction out of it. Sleep less, you probably get less satisfaction. But it ought to work out so that if you're going to be kind of having used all these circles, if you're going to be a rounded person, you ought to have some sort of correlation between the connections and the time that you spend. Now, this is just to sort of get you to think about the way that you spend your time. I'm going to talk now about cultural patterns in spending time, the way that Americans in general spend time, and then you'll have to sort of make your own connections. Does this describe me, or does this describe somebody else? Is this something that I can apply to my life, or is it not at all? And in the middle of this, I'm going to talk about time management, because time management is a real important thing in America today, partly because of our conceptions of time. And I found over at the bookstore here this morning, on the 50% off table, a book on Christian time management. So I bought it, and I'll pass it around, and you can figure out how to manage your time while I'm talking here, which would be just a wonderful, wonderful example of time management, wouldn't it? You could listen to this lecture and manage your time and learn how to manage your time at the same time. But another reason that I bought it is that it has a picture of an alarm clock on the front of it. And this is really what I'm going to begin talking about today. I'm going to talk about my alarm clock and what my alarm clock tells us. And this is pretty much the alarm clock that's in our room. So this is the one that I'm talking about. Okay, again, as I said to the people the other day, I don't lecture in my classes at St. Olaf. And so I'm not real good at it. I also have no train of thought when I'm lecturing. I've kind of written a lecture here because you haven't done the reading that I would normally have required of my St. Olaf students. And so I want to give you something to think about before we begin to talk. But there is no train of thought going on here. Confusion is really the name of the game here. If I can confuse you, I will be very, very happy. Confusion comes from a Latin root, confundere, which means a flowing together of things. And so that's what I'm hoping to do today, is to bring a lot of things together, to try to make a lot of things flow together. And they may still be kind of swirling around at the end. In fact, I hope they're still swirling around at the end, because I don't think I have the answers to this. And I'd hate to think that you are all that much faster than I am. Anyway, alarming. As far as biblical scholars can tell, there were no alarm clocks in the Garden of Eden. There was morning and evening of the first day and of the second day and of all 7 days of creation, but no alarm clocks. It's alarming to think about an alarm clock. Normally, I notice it just twice a day. I see it at night and I hear it in the morning. I glance at it as I climb into bed to see how late I've stayed up and to gauge quickly how much rest I might get. 6 or 7 hours later, it bleeps until Barb turns it off. It's on her side of the bed. It signals the beginning of my day, but it signifies a whole lot more. Today, I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about the moral ecology of an alarm clock, to consider the problem of invisible complexity involved in waking up to an alarm, to think through the social traps of our social construction of time, and to wake up to our complicity in the complexities of American time. And we think of time as being something that's just neutral and out there, but there is such a thing as American time. We have devised it in a particular way in this country. It's different when you go to different kinds of countries. My alarm clock, as you can see in the picture on that book that's going around there, is a Spartus model 1158-61, produced by the Spartus Corporation of Louisville, Mississippi. It is not made in Louisville, Mississippi, however. It's made in China. And so it connects me, even in my sleep, to international markets, to trade deficits, and to possible protectionism. It also connects me to people working long hours for wages that I would consider scandalously low under conditions that are scandalously primitive in a country with scandalous human rights policies. But I am usually ignorant of this, and so I sleep right through my complicity with these cultural patterns. Until I began to write this paper, I was ignorant in the conventional sense that I did not know where my alarm was made. The invisible complexity of American markets covered my complicity. I bought it at Kmart. That was as far as I needed to think about it. Now I am ignorant in an entirely different way, and in what I think is in many ways a more conventional way for Americans. I'm ignorant not because I don't know. I'm ignorant because I choose to ignore what I do know, and I still sleep soundly. There are many, many ways in American culture where we ignore what we know. My alarm clock is an electric alarm clock, so it depends on power produced by Northern States Power in its coal-fired generators or nuclear reactors. More than 40% of Minnesota's electrical power is supplied by nuclear energy, so I am voting, while I sleep, for the continuation of nuclear power, and by extension of the nuclear fuel cycle, I am exposing miners to cancer and future generations to radioactive waste. But the coal-powered portion of my electric alarm is not clean either. Coal-fired generators contribute sulfur dioxide to the air, which causes acid rain to fall in eastern Canada and New England. But I ignore this too, and I sleep right through the ecological impact of my alarm clock. It's a digital alarm, as you can see in the picture there. So it has all of the modernistic associations that digital displays have in a culture increasingly infatuated with computers. The digits run in two 12-hour sequences with a tiny red dot denoting the difference between forenoon and afternoon. The two 12s make 24, giving me time abstracted and objectified, and marking me as one of those humans who believe that 24 hours constitute a day, an entirely social construction, but one that we think of as entirely natural. These two dozen hours structure our days and create a framework for cultural relations. This clock and others like it are signs of a social construction of reality. The alarm clock has, as the one in the picture does, a snoozer, which is a device that I have never been able to understand. I dislike the sound of my alarm clock, and I have never wanted to hear it twice in one morning. But many people take great psychological pleasure in the extra minute of sleep that a snoozer allows. Now, most people set the alarm on days when they have to go to work, and Barb and I are no different. We assume, as most Americans do, that we must be on time for work. In fact, another thing that we could think about here is, why are all of you here at this time? I mean, one of the things that time does for it is that it coordinates people a lot in bureaucracies. Otherwise, we might have wandered in at all kinds of different hours. I might have started at some other sort of time. But all of us managed to get here at on or about 11:40 because that was what was in the schedule. And we all did that because we were paying attention in one way or another to the time around here. And I'm working, so I had to be on time for work. And that's why I'm here. Some of us, in fact, punch time clocks as we go to work, but for almost all of us, punctuality is a virtue in the workplace where we sell our time for money. In my life, work is the only event that I set an alarm clock for, which gives some sense, I think, of the centrality of work in this culture. In terms of time, Americans are the world's workaholics. Only the Japanese work more than we do. But while their work week is still shrinking, ours is increasing. In the last 20 years, Americans have annually added about 9 hours to their time at work. This doesn't sound like much, but over 20 years, it's almost an extra month of work. We are what Juliet Shore calls in a recent book, overworked Americans, and we work what she calls long-hour jobs. The time that we devote to work is time not devoted to other things, so that we have less time for family, for sociability, for leisure, for lifelong learning, for sleep. Studies show that a majority of Americans get 60 to 90 minutes less sleep than they should. And experts say that if you need an alarm clock, you're probably not getting enough sleep. Work time is mandatory in America's social construction of reality, but it's still a social construction. We have chosen to spend our time at work. Since 1948, the productivity of American workers has doubled. Absolutely doubled since 1948, which means that we have had the choice to work less or to consume more. We could have chosen the 4-hour day. We could have chosen the 20-hour week. We could have chosen the 6-month vacation or a sabbatical every other year. But as Alan Derning shows in his book, How Much is Enough?, we have chosen to consume more with all of the ecological consequences of that consumption. We forget that time, clock time, is a relatively recent invention. In America, for example, the alarm clock dates only to the 1870s, when the Seth Thomas Clock Company in Connecticut began to market its wind-up device. Largely irrelevant to agricultural populations who regulated their activity by the sun and the seasons, clock time was applied to coordinate the activities of people at work in industrial production or bureaucratic organizations. In a way, Holden is a kind of bureaucratic organization, and clocks are used here to coordinate the time, to coordinate the meetings that we want to have together. The clock, not the steam engine, insisted Lewis Mumford, is the key machine of the modern industrial age. It is a piece of power machinery whose product is seconds and minutes. In manufacturing such a product, Neil Postman confirms in a wonderful book called Amusing Ourselves to Death, the clock has the effect of disassociating time from human events and thus nourishes the belief in an independent world of mathematically measurable sequences. Moment to moment, it turns out, is not God's conception or nature's. It is man conversing with himself about and through a piece of machinery he has created. During the 19th century, this idea of time got really popular in the United States. You could read the time often came into towns with the railroad. The railroad would come through and have to be punctual, and so the railroad wanted to get its time schedules all set. And in fact, standard times and the time zones that we have are invented in the 1880s for the benefit of railroads, because until that time, noon in every city in the United States was the time at which the sun was directly overhead. And so noon moved across the country, mile after mile after mile, and it was very difficult for railroads to calculate schedules when noon moved every 5 miles. So they wanted a whole bunch of people to celebrate noon at the same time, even though the sun was not overhead. And so they created this social construction of these time zones so that they could set things up. Factories were also important in the sort of invention of a kind of time consciousness in the 19th century. Factories and factory whistles and bells were real important and were invariably seen as signs of progress in small towns, that now we have something that tells us the time. There's a whistle goes off at certain times during the day, in the morning, at noon, in the afternoon. Okay, time also gets popularized in the 19th century with devices that I can see that many of you are wearing, devices called watches. They weren't at first worn on the wrist. They were usually carried in the pocket. A watch is, according to Webster, a small timepiece carried in the pocket or worn on the wrist for the purpose of telling time. A broader definition of watch, though, if you look in the dictionary, is, quote, the act or fact of keeping awake, especially of keeping awake and alert in order to look after, protect, and guard. In this sense, a watch invites us to look at the alarming complexities of watches and alarm clocks, and to see our complicity in the cultural production of common sense that they represent. This is a phrase that I really like a lot, the cultural production of common sense. For many things, you know, we're sort of looking at sort of everyday life, we simply say it's common sense. But common sense is almost always culturally produced. It's a way that we have talked to ourselves over time. Historically, we've located things. They've become so important to us that we now call them common sense. But at some time, they were somebody's choice. In the 19th century, you can see the popularity of these watches in the Horatio Alger stories, which were the kind of rags-to-riches stories of the 19th century. It usually starts with a young boy, very poor, trying to make his way in the world. He gets a little bit of money. The first thing he does with the bit of money that he gets is buy a watch. The second thing he does with the next bit of money he gets is to open a bank account. And so you have here, first of all, this kind of time consciousness and punctuality that's important to Victorian America, and this idea of deferred gratification represented by the bank account in these stories. It's a kind of invariable sort of thing. Anyway, in this cultural production of common sense, it is common sense to think that we have time to save or spend, because Americans have a proprietary sense of time. We treat it like property, like money, for as Benjamin Franklin told us, time is money. In a capitalist society, the abstraction of time has become commodified. We save time, we buy time with labor-saving devices. And then once we have acquired it, we spend time with families and friends. One study showed that Americans use about 10.5 hours a day taking care of bodily needs. Eating, sleeping, personal care, 7.5 hours at work, and about 1/2 hour of child care. This leaves 6 hours of discretionary time, two of which we use on the average watching TV, which is our foremost choice pastime in this country, 1.5 hours in casual social interaction, 50 minutes in travel, not including commuting, and 30 minutes in resting or miscellaneous leisure. This leaves time for an average of 12 minutes of study, 10 minutes of religion, 8 minutes of sports, 6 minutes for entertainment and cultural events, and 6 minutes for voluntary organizations. You can see that these are all averages. It would be ridiculous to have a day that worked out like this. Well, I'm having my 8 minutes of sports now and my 6 minutes for entertainment and cultural events. I mean, it does work out over variations during our days. But this time that we spend tells us a lot about what we value. When we say that we don't have time to do something that we ought to do, what we mean is that we have culturally constructed our time so that those things are not priorities. What we mean is, if we really thought that religion was as important as TV, we would culturally contrive to devote 2 hours a day to it. But it's not as important culturally, so that we don't. Time gives us a calculus of utility, partly because of the time and motion studies of people like Frederick Winslow Taylor at the turn of the century. We define efficiency, which is a key word in American culture and has a lot to do with all of these time management things, We define efficiency as the amount of work you can accomplish in a given amount of time. And recently, we are restructuring workplaces to become even more efficient. I think it's one of the big things going on in American culture right now is the restructuring of workplaces. And they're getting more and more efficient, and they're also getting more and more stressful for the people in the workplaces. And we've also done, in our definition of efficiency, we've neglected the amount of fossil energy that we substitute for human energy in efficiency. We think of it, of efficiency as being the amount of human time, the amount of human effort that's used to accomplish a certain job. And so we kind of keep the fossil fuel stuff as a kind of part of the invisible complexity of efficiency. We have type A personalities with a strained sense of urgency of what needs to be done. I'm not one of them. But even those of us with type B or Q or Z personalities often seem stressed by time, wishing that there were more than 24 hours in the day. A recent Northwestern National Life Insurance survey showed that more than half of American workers feel highly stressed. The study also showed Americans suffering from stress-related maladies, 62% feeling exhausted, 62% angry or anxious, 60% with muscle pain, 45% with headaches, 45% unable to sleep. But even with these symptoms, we generally choose not to change, but to cope with the social constructions of work. We collectively create a social problem, which I think is the way that we work in this country. We collectively create that problem, but we ask individuals to solve it in their own lives. We pay very little cultural, collective, political attention to workplaces in this country. Consequently, since we've taken this social problem and we've shifted all of the responsibility for it to individuals, we now have a whole industry of time management. Books and tapes tell us how to use our time efficiently, and many products help us to schedule our time effectively. I use a book called The Uncalendar, which requires me to number all of the days of the year. So I have to sit down once a year and sort of fill in all the numbers and all the days on these pages. But the pages have just sort of the right size things for me, for filling in the few things that I do during the day. But there are many more sophisticated devices. My wife, who is in business, has one of these things called day timers. I don't know if you have seen them, but they're just incredible. You can program your time down to the quarter second in these things, and there's space enough to write down what you're doing in each quarter second also. At St. Olaf, at the beginning of the school year, each student receives a publication called The Book, which helps to teach students how to fit into the busyness of American life. At college, I think, for all that we teach these academic subjects, one of the things that we teach best is to how to fit in within workplaces that are highly stressed. And I think more and more college students are beginning to experience the stresses that we have in American workplaces. And the book is a way of helping them to do that. The book has already filled in for each day the academic deadlines, the sports and entertainment events that are happening at the college, and it leaves room for students to schedule their frantic lives. More recently, there are computer calendars to help us make the most of our time. Ads for new products like microwave ovens and cellular phones and fax machines also assure us that these technologies will allow us to master the time that we are allotted. In the Minneapolis area, US West sells cellular phones that are, quote, making the most of your time at a Watts number. You can call this Watts number if you want to get one of these cellular phones, 1-800-BUY-TIME. And the sense of spending and buying time is absolutely explicit there. It's interesting in this regard how we feel personally responsible for the lack of time in our lives when society structures so many of the time-wasting features of it. Commuting is a wonderful example of such a social trap. Americans waste billions of hours and tremendous amounts of gas getting to and from work, and we do it because we all go to work at about the same time, and because we all drive cars, and because we live in suburban developments that require us to drive cars. But there are ways in which we could socially reconfigure the landscape so that this wouldn't happen. If we structured spatial arrangements differently, if we rethought the separate zoning of business and residential space, if we adjusted the times that we all go to work, we might, socially at least, begin to redeem the time now spent swearing in and swearing at cars during commute time. And commute time becomes a part of sort of common sense for us. I always leave to go to St. Olaf at a little bit before 7 so that I miss rush hour. But rush hour for me is simply a given. I never think, is there a way that you could socially reconstruct rush hour? It's just given. But there are ways that we could socially reconstruct rush hour if we chose to. Anyway, in these time-saving products and many others, we buy convenience packaged in a multiplicity of forms. But one, in fact, is convenience, and what does it cost? The cost of convenience often is consideration, and the cost of consideration is often quality and environmental degradation. One of the examples of that is these little soup mixes and dinners that are now being packaged for one person in these little plastic cups. Those little plastic cups are going to go into landfills in sort of extraordinary numbers. And there's a lot of packaging involved in convenience foods, and also a lot of processing and energy that goes into them also. We conventionally think of these time-saving devices as a good thing because we're really programmed to think of saving time. But E.F. Schumacher, the author of Small is Beautiful, offers as his first law of economics that the amount of real leisure a society enjoys tends to be in inverse proportion to the amount of labor-saving machinery it employs. So you think about it, we use an extraordinary amount of labor-saving machinery, but we don't have a lot of leisure in this country. And this goes way back in American culture. When the English first encountered Indians in New England, they thought the Indians were lazy because they worked, as most hunter-gatherers do, only 15 or 20 hours a week, providing for themselves, with the rest of the time spent in leisure and community festivals and just kind of talking, and in various kinds of what we might call sports. And the Indians couldn't figure out why the English worked so damn much. I mean, here you are in a country where you can get by just working 15 or 20 hours a week, and you can do very well. The Indians had one convention that the English found extraordinarily puzzling. And the Indians would they'd save up enough food to get them through the winter, but not enough that they would they'd be full all the way through. There was one month in the year that they simply called the starving time. And it was a time when people were very, very hungry because there wasn't enough. It was usually February or March, or somewhere in February and March. And for about a month, they were very, very hungry. And the English looked at them and thought, this is just nuts, you know, because if you worked a lot harder, you could save up enough stuff over the winter. But the Indians thought, it's not worth the extra effort to do it. Better to have this time in our year, the sort of cultural part of the cycle of the year in which we are hungry, rather than to work like these English people who they thought were more like slaves. We are descendants of the English because we allot a great proportion of our time to work and very little to socializing or to social issues. And that has to do with work. Now I want to talk about leisure time because that's really opposed to work. In the United States, many of us spend our time at work so that we can have free time or time of our own in the evenings or on work weekends. And I think the term free time is a wonderfully interesting term. If it's free time, what's the rest of the time? It's slave time. Free time is free of the obligations and duties of school or work or church or other formal organizations. Free time is opposed to this slave time, the time in which we are bound to someone else. Free time is personal time and is part of the expressive individualism of American culture. Time of our own is the time when we can be ourselves, time when we can use the creative capacities that often stand idle at work. Time of our own means that at work we cannot normally be ourselves. Time of our own means that at work we cannot normally use our creative capacities. Time of our own is the socially constructed compensation for the alienated work which we have also socially constructed for ourselves. Some historians refer to what they call the Great Compromise, which occurs early in the 20th century, where essentially American workers say to manufacturers, we're willing to put up with dumb, stupid work as long as you pay us a lot and allow us enough time to buy things, to consume as our compensation for the alienated labor that you want us to do. Henry Ford was one of the first people really to catch on to this in 1914. He instituted the $5 day at the Ford Motor Company and really doubled the wages of people in his factories. Partly as a way of keeping them on the assembly line, which was horrible, horrible work at that time. The turnover rates at the Ford factories until that time were about 300% a year, and Ford wanted people to stick around and stay on the line, so he would pay them a lot to do that. The work was horrible work to do. The workers would do it if they got paid enough to consume, and Ford also figured that if they consumed, they'd buy Fords. And in fact, his factories enforced that. If you drove a Chevrolet to the Ford factory, you were in deep trouble. But instead of changing these social constructions so that work is fulfilling to human beings, which is one thing that we might think about doing with work, again, we commute to the job in cars with bumper stickers that say, "I live for weekends." I've seen lots of those. But free time is also not free of cultural definitions. We think it is. We think that time of our own is our free time. But there are lots of cultural definitions that go along with free time as well. If the week belongs to work, the weekend belongs to Mikola, circumspect sort of way. The work you're doing is kind of dumb, and so you deserve a break. Eat at McDonald's. It will make you feel better about doing the dumb things that you're doing. Miller time does the same thing, the old beer ad for Miller time. You've worked hard, now it's Miller time. Now you can be among people where there's a kind of social conviviality that there can't be at work. And we've been taught more and more that leisure means the consumption of leisure products, not that it means really free time of our own. Free time is time without an alarm clock. We must rise on weekends, but many of us sleep. We must rise on weekdays, but many of us sleep in on weekends, a kind of time out of time in American culture. Now, one of the days of the weekend, there's a wonderful book, by the way, by a man whose name I can't pronounce. His first name is Witold, W-I-T-O-L-D, and his last name is Rybaczynski, I think, some Polish name. He's a professor of architecture in Canada, and he's written a book called Waiting for the Weekend, which describes, it's called Waiting for the Weekend. It's a history of the weekend. It tells you where the weekend came from and what it means. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. Anyway, one of the days of the weekend is Sunday, which used to be known in Judeo-Christian cultures as the Sabbath. The Sabbath used to be a sacred time, a time of rest and reflection, a time when Christians considered how to, quote, redeem the time. With the Sabbath, there's also a wonderful history of the Sabbath by one of my mentors at the University of Illinois with that title, Redeem the Time, because that was the idea of the Sabbath. It was a time when you thought about how to redeem the rest of the time, how to use your life in the sort of co-creation with God or in the kind of saving grace. How to use your life in that way. With the Sabbath, people culturally constructed a time to listen to the sacred, which is the theme of this summer here at Holden. It was a cultural convention to listen to the sacred and to apply the wisdom of holiness to their everyday lives. It reflected the notion set out in the story of Genesis that God had created time out of eternity for the purposeful use of God's creatures and then commanded the creatures to use it wisely. Failing that initial wisdom in the Garden of Eden, the creatures were required to participate in the work of redemption by redeeming the time assigned to them to build the kingdom of God on earth. Although many religious Americans still attend church services on Sunday, we lack, I think, that sense of sacred time and of redeeming the time. Sundays are now more a part of the conventional cultural weekend, which is the kind of consumption kind of thing, and it's shown in the fact that we allow all kinds of commercial businesses and entertainments to be open. There are many countries in the world, in fact, I think still most countries in the world, restrict the number of things that can be open on Sunday because Sunday is still supposed to be set apart as a kind of sacred time. Where an earlier Christian culture told time by the Angelus bells, the word clock, after all, comes from the French word cloche, meaning bell. And the Angelus was 6 in the morning and 6 at night, the bell would ring, and you're supposed to stop whatever you're doing and pray at that time. And that provided a religious frame for the day. We are more secular, of or pertaining to the temporal rather than the spiritual, than we are sacred. Now, vacations are also a way of changing the time. Many of us are here at Holden to redeem the time of our lives, and you could do some of the same kinds of things with vacations. Vacations are really a way of shifting us out of conventions of time that are associated largely with workplaces into other patterns of time. And I think probably most of us here at Holden feel more relaxed than we do in our everyday lives because we have culturally constructed a place where time is different. Okay, now my alarm clock, this Spartus alarm model 1158-61, tells me the time, or more precisely, it tells me one social construction of time. But in focusing my attention on one dimension of time, it also helps me to ignore other important times of our lives. The clock, for example, is the embodiment of American presentism. It will flash up there that it is 12:22, and 1 minute later it will flash up there that it is 12:23. It tells me about today, or this precise minute. Some clocks and watches even have a calendar feature so that I know exactly which day of the month it is. But it doesn't connect me to yesterday or tomorrow. Yesterday, my clock presumes, is history, and tomorrow is science fiction. By ignoring yesterday, the clock keeps us from being mindful of the ways that we are creations of the past. All of the ideas and institutions that I'm talking about this week are the creations of dead people. We are the incarnation of the past. We are the embodiment of the past, and we are responsible to the past. We also need to conserve the best of the past. But too often we think, as the aphorism has it, that today is just the first day of the rest of our lives, just to say, begin with the present and go to the future. Wendell Berry's poem, At a Country Funeral, is a lovely reminder of the potency of the past in our lives. A farmer has died, and Berry describes the funeral. And this is from the poem. Now the old dead wait in the open coffin for the blood kin to gather, come home for one last time, to hear old men whose tongues bear an essential topography speak memories doomed to die. But our memory of ourselves hard-earned is one of the land's seeds, as a seed is the memory of the life of its kind in its place, to pass on into life the knowledge of what has died. Let me read that one again. I really like that. But our memory of ourselves, hard-earned, is the memory of its of the life of its kind in its place, to pass on into life the knowledge of what has died. And then another wonderful, wonderful sentence. What we owe the future is not a new start, which Americans are always doing. This is my parenthesis in here. Americans do this all the time. New start, new beginning, new frontier, new deal. We always want to start anew. But Berry says, what we owe this future is not a new start, for we can only begin with what has happened. We owe the future the past, the long knowledge that is the potency of time to come. That makes a man's grave a rich furrow. The community of knowing in common is the seed of our life in this place. There is not only no better possibility, there is no other except for chaos and darkness, the terrible ground of the only possible new start. And so as the old die and the young depart, where shall a man go who keeps the memories of the dead, except home again, as one would go back after a burial, faithful to the fields, lest the dead die a second and more final death. And that second and more final death would be if we forgot them, if we forgot the traditions that bind us. This is one of the things that made me very nervous when Guy was talking about virtual reality the other day. Because that sense of not much of a sense of the past or the tradition involved in that. Well, if it's alarming that my alarm clock keeps me from the past, it is also alarming that it keeps me from the future. Americans, I think, are ambivalent about the future now. We used to think that the future would always be better than the past because we believed in progress. But now the future isn't what it used to be because we begin to see the deferred costs of the past's profligacy. We do make some personal preparations for the future as we educate ourselves to get jobs, to make money, to pay for retirement, or in my case, you invest in retirement programs or you put money aside for college education or something like that. So we do make some personal preparations for the future, but we don't have very many public plans for the future. We don't often think that we are accountable to the future. We tend not to be very mindful of future generations in American public life at all. And when we are, we often ask, in effect, what has the future ever done for us? In Minnesota, a bumper sticker boasts, I'm spending my children's inheritance. These are the people that I would just sort of want to run over on the road. And so we perpetuate a kind of structural violence on the long unborn that we don't even see. This conception of the future also appears in our cultural neglect of children, who are the poorest of Americans. You look at who are most of the poor people, it's children, and they are the future. Our ancestors, however, had a different idea of the future that they expressed by the term posterity, not much used in American culture these days. They also tended to think further ahead than many contemporary Americans do. When asked why he was involved in the politics of the American Revolution, John Adams, for example, said, I must study politics and war so that my sons may study diplomacy, so that their sons may be involved in business, so that their sons may be involved in the arts. Four generations ahead, he was thinking, in a perfectly sexist way, but four generations ahead. And what's interesting about the Adams family is he got it exactly right. In his family, his son, John Quincy Adams, was the first ambassador to Russia and was involved in diplomacy, later became president of the United States. And then, I think even more interesting than being president of the United States, after he was president of the United States, he decided he could still serve, and he ran for the House of Representatives and served in the House of Representatives again, something that would be unthinkable now for a president. I mean, which sort of you peak when you're president and you could never serve in any other public office again because you're too important to be in the House of Representatives. Anyway, John Quincy Adams' son was Charles Francis Adams, who was a railroad magnate in the sort of eastern corridor of railroads that were built in the mid-19th century. And his two sons were Henry Adams, the first president of the American Historical Association, and a great American writer. One of the really wonderful books in American literature is The Education of Henry Adams. And his brother was Brooks Adams, also interested in artistic and aesthetic kinds of things. And so that thinking ahead for four generations worked just perfectly in the Adams family. This was also true in the Mohawk tribes. When the Mohawk tribes got together to think about policy decisions, they tried to anticipate what the consequences would be for the seventh generation. What are we doing now, and what would the impact be on the seventh generation? Most Americans have a hard time thinking past the next election, which is 4 years. Jimmy Carter, in his term in office, Jimmy Carter, I think, will be remembered as the first of our 21st century presidents, because Carter had a kind of complexity of vision that I think presidents will have to have in the 21st century. He commissioned a study called Global 2000. This was in the late 1970s. And it was trying to anticipate up to the year 2000 what might be going on. But that's a mere 22 years. That's only a generation. And that was considered too far-sighted. It was really, the whole project was really disbanded in the Reagan administration and by people whose sense of the future goes no further than the next election. We don't think much of the future as something that we create today, both by our actions and by our inactivity. And as a result, the future that we are creating is not one that many of us would like to live in. I got involved in the anti-nuclear movement in 1979 when my first son was born. 1979 happened to be a very bad year in terms of nuclear history. All kinds of things, with Three Mile Island happened, the uprising in Iran happened, Sandinistas in Nicaragua. The Progressive published an article on how to make a hydrogen bomb. SALT II treaty fell through. The Soviets invaded Afghanistan. A whole bunch of bad things happened there. My son is born, I think, normal life expectancy in this country is around 70 for a male. He's going to live to the year 2050. Who is thinking about the year 2050 anymore? And who thinks that there really will be a year 2050 if nuclear things go on the way they are? So I'm sort of thinking now one generation, because I have these kids that I'm trying to think about in terms of that far. But it would be better if I would even think in terms of two or three generations, their kids, that sort of thing. Okay, now my clock, even if my clock could locate me in a stream of historical continuity, if it could tell me something about history, if it could tell me something about the future, it still would not necessarily connect me to biological or ecological time. The clock denotes the social construction of human time, but it doesn't tell much about other rhythms of the universe. The clock, for example, ignores the circadian rhythms of biological beings, those changes in the functioning of the flesh that are determined by our being animals. The circadian rhythms of our bodies tend to operate, I don't know a lot about this, tend to operate on a 25-hour cycle. A 24-hour day somehow just doesn't work with it. And the way that we structure our days, too, has something to do with it doesn't really fit with the kinds of energy flows that we get in our circadian rhythms. As I understand it, there's an energy flow that kind of goes up until around lunchtime or shortly after, and then energy tends to drop off for a short while, and then it comes up again. It's sort of a two-bell curve. And the institution of the siesta is one that culturally recognizes, in a way, circadian rhythms. But we're not big on siestas. In fact, if I took a nap at work between, say, 1 and 3 o'clock, my colleagues would get really suspicious of me. My raises would go down, and that sort of thing. The clock is also silent about earth time, about geological time, about the long cycles of prairies and forests and oceans. As a measure of biological time, for example, we might take the amount of time that it takes to make an inch of soil, which is about 500 years. And we might consider that when we live in a way that depletes soil faster than that, we are in a sense working against time. We are not on time, no matter how fast or productive we might be. And if nature's time is also God's time, then we ought to have an alarm to alert us when we transgress its limits. While natural rhythms are essentially cyclical, Americans believe in a more linear construction of time. We think that time flows in one direction, and this idea of progress that we've really grown up with, the whole country is founded on an idea of progress, is one that sees time in a linear sort of way, and it makes it difficult for us to sort of get into a sense of nature's time. This idea of improvement over the flow of time, this idea of progress, is hard to argue against in a country like the United States that's been so blessed. But Martin Luther King was one important American who did. In his letter from Birmingham jail, he argued against, quote, the strangely irrational notion that there is something in the flow of time that will inevitably cure all ills. Actually, he insisted, time itself is neutral. It can be used either destructively or constructively. More and more, I feel that the people of ill will have used time much more effectively than the people of goodwill. We will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the hateful words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people. Human progress never rolls in on wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts of people willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the forces of social stagnation. In an almost Puritan sense, King seems to be saying that we need to redeem the time, that sense of the Sabbath and of Puritanism also. King's sense that we are co-workers or co-creators with God suggests as well that we exist in what might be called God's time, another dimension of time that doesn't get caught in the liquid crystals of my alarm clock. The time that we measure is only an element of eternity, and the lives that we measure by the clock may also end in immortality or time out of time. So in the broadest sense, what does my alarm clock awaken me to? Normally, it awakens me to the routines of my day, which is culturally produced for me, and I can run through the routines almost without thinking. But in a broader sense, an alarm is a warning of danger, and in that sense, my clock sounds an alarm that to everything there is a season and a time and place under heaven. It places us in a context of creation and redemption and alarms us that we seldom take the time to reflect about that fact. It reminds me that my time is a gift from God, that the way I spend my time is my identity and my values, and that, as Karen Christensen says in a wonderful book called Home Ecology, taking time to consider how you want to spend the time of your life is the first step in home ecology. This ringing alarm also awakens me, when I am awake to what it means, to the possibility of conspiring or breathing together with God and with God's people for a future time in which Christ's promises are fulfilled. It brings me, as Robert Penn Warren says at the end of All the King's Men, out of history and into history and the awful responsibility of time. I'll stop there. We can all take a deep breath. Thank God he's done. It's at that time already. Have any comments, questions, arguments?
The African has a wonderful expression when he asks, do you know the difference between you Westerners and us Africans? And I respond, well, I've seen a few, but they have in mind. And he says, well, you've got the watch and I've got the time.
You've got the watch and I've got the time. That's wonderful.
If you like to see this tension, you might, I don't know, in America you're not likely to see this book, but it's called The Song of Lawino, written by an Ugandan poet named Bitek. And it's a story of how an African traditional woman married an African man who became well-educated and very modernized and who lived by the watch.
Oh.
And she resented all of this, his coming home and telling her it's time to feed the baby. She said, we don't feed the baby according to the clock, we feed the baby according to the baby's needs. I'm not. But anyway, it's a book that succinctly gives you a picture of that tension, The Song of Lawino.
Can you spell that?
By Bitek. There's a P with an apostrophe followed by a B-I-T-E-K. E-K. You might find it in some large library.
Thank you. Yeah, that, I mean, that one of the things that happens there is that we have been in clock time for so long that it's hard for us to imagine any other sorts of time. It used to be that time could be measured by things that one did, so that you would say, I'll meet you in a rice boiling. And since everybody in that particular culture knew about how long it took to boil rice, that was a perfectly acceptable bit of time, you know, of time. And now we'd be absolutely confused by that, because are we using minute rice or long grain wild rice or what? You know, it would not work in this culture. But in other cultures, you could do it in that way. It's also true that even when the days were invented and divided up into hours, it used to be that the hours were of different lengths during the day, depending on the seasons. That the hours would be the hours of the day, there would be like 12 hours in the day, and no matter how many, quote, conventional 60-minute hours of daylight there were, so they would just kind of stretch. So you might have some 70-minute hours in the days, and it took a while until they got it all conventionalized so that we'd always have these 60-minute hours. They seem like 60 hours sometimes, 60-minute hours in the day. But it's real hard for us to sort of think out of the conventions of our culture, which are so mathematical and so precise.
There's an article in the latest issue of Ugly Reader, and it talks about the nouveau poor, and it talks about young people generally in their 30s and 40s, and some in their 20s, who don't have conventional jobs. They do waitressing or freelance stuff.
Yeah.
But they don't have conventional jobs, and most of them say they're just allergic to 9-to-5 work. And but it says that one of the things that moves people out of this is healthcare. That you need a 9-to-5 job and that kind of setting to get proper healthcare in this country. It talks about how some of these people do things like bargaining, like. You know, somebody will do someone else's hair if they'll take off some of the rent.
Yeah, things, right. And moving back in a way to a barter economy in some ways that does free people up from the kinds of conventions of time that we have. I mean, actually being a college professor is one of the occupations in American life where there aren't a whole lot of time constraints on us. I mean, I teach classes. I mean, I have to be in classes 6 hours a week, and so I have to, at those particular times, I have to be there, and I have office hours that are posted. But most of the rest of my time is a kind of task time. It's a time that I really have pretty much on my own. I have an extraordinary amount of autonomy with the way that I use my time, and I think it's one of the reasons that I enjoy it so much, because it's just a delight to know that I have a lot of flexibility with it. Since I study American culture, I tend to be at work all the time. You know, when I go to the movies, I'm there sort of as a student of American culture and as somebody watching the movies. So there's sort of this schizophrenic me there doing it all the time. But it's fun that way. And another thing about about being an academic, which I'm about to enjoy in this coming year, is that every 7 years we get a sabbatical, which I think would be just wonderful for this country if people got sabbaticals. It wouldn't need to be a whole year, but a whole year is very nice. But I mean, I have a year now in which I have time to think. I can think about the way my classes are going. I can think about the relation of my work time to my family time. I can think about the research that I might be interested in doing. And in fact, this is part of it. What the research project that I'm interested in right now is a book called Habits of My Heart, The Moral Ecology of Everyday Life. And so what I'm going to be studying is my grocery bills, my utility bills. My lawn, the sort of things around the house, to try to figure out what are the cultural patterns that go into my life. And it's just a wonderful opportunity to be able to step back from the teaching, and that's not all that hectic to begin with, but to step back from that and have this time for reflection. Americans are almost allergic to reflection, I think, and it makes it very difficult for us to think through these very complex patterns of our lives. Bruce?
One of the things that just really struck me when you were talking is that the way we have constructed time reinforces the sense of fragmentation that we feel, both in our relationships as well as in our... And it struck me yesterday, I missed your session because of a poetry reading outside, and it was it spoke somewhat to what you're talking about. In one of the poems, it talked about the just person justices. And it's that sense of within time, we somehow fragment our time instead of seeing ourselves as whole people. The time forces us to categorize our time so that we don't become whole people. At this time, we're doing this, and we're this type of person. At this time, we're doing this. And so we lose that sense of flow.
Yeah, and this is something that's true. I think I see it most in education because this is where I am most of the time. But education largely teaches students not to be themselves. I have students who describe to me how they go about writing a research paper, and what they say is I turn on a crank that produces academic language, and this sort of extraordinary mechanical image that goes on there. There's a crank in my brain, and I turn it on, and it throws out this academic language that professors like to read, but it's not me. And one of the ways that you get around that not me is to ask students to do journals, for one thing. And in American studies classes, this is a real delight because they can write about anything. You know, what did you have for breakfast this morning? Well, that's a study in American cultural patterns. Or what is breakfast? Or why is it that at the cafeteria at St. Olaf there are two lines and one of the lines has always longer than the others, than the other? It's because there's a cool line and a nerd line, I found out. Which just absolutely mystifies me, but it's sort of the anthropology of lines, and I get them to think about that. Well, what does it mean to be cool or to be a nerd in getting breakfast, for God's sake, you know? And then what does it mean to have hierarchies like that? And what kind of people sit on the cool side and the nerd side? And how do you dress if you're going to sit? And there are actually different codes of dress for the different sides of the cafeteria, and get people to think about that, or to think about things in their everyday lives. One of the things that we do is you sort of have to get them out of thinking in academic terms. And so one of the things I do is we do an American Studies Museum in this class where I ask them to just, you have to take an artifact that you found on campus, and then you have to write a 15-page paper on it. So it might be on a Coke can. You have to write 15 pages on what does a Coke can tell you about American culture. It's much in the same way I've done this with this alarm clock this morning. What does a Coke can tell you about American culture? Then you have to condense that 15-page paper to a one-page single-space paper. And then we actually open a museum at St. Olaf. We get a room, and for one day, we have this museum with HHS Coke cans and credit cards and student IDs and keys. And all of these things are wonderful ways of getting at the culture. But since there's not any way that you can go to a book and look up, you know, what does a Coke can mean in American culture? So you have to give them research projects where there are no answers in books. And then they really start thinking on their own, and it's wonderful because they come up with some really fascinating stuff. It's really a delight.
I'm curious to know, in your classes, do you go beyond the dissemination of information and the exposure, allowing the student to understand the complexities of American culture. Do you personally try to bring about change in behaviors within your students in their daily lives, or even do you inspire them to try to bring about institutional changes that you are back exposing them to, or do you merely just let them carry that ball?
I mainly think it's my function to get them to think and decide what they want to do, but not my function to suggest to them, except by example, what they might do. So one of the things that I do a lot in classes, since these are classes on American culture, is I talk a lot about myself and my family and my these cultures. I might talk about my alarm clock. I might talk about my kids. This one is inseparable from his watch, even though his father doesn't wear one at all. When we talk about cars, I can talk about him also, because there are cultural patterns that come up in him with cars. You bet. There are nerd cars and there are cool cars. We had two cars that were over 100,000 miles. Yeah, and the ones that I have are nerd cars. But, I mean, in terms of cars, the age 16, I think it's an all-important age in American culture. It is where we have our ritual of passage to adulthood, and we do it by giving people driver's licenses at age 16. To my mind, it's really a very bad ritual of coming to adulthood. we could do it in a much more interesting and complex kind of way that would make responsible adults. But that's not the way that we do it. I think it is the ritual that is mainly signifies adulthood in American culture, and so people look forward to it with extraordinary passion. But anyway, I will talk about that. Our family life is somewhat unconventional. I do all of the cooking in our home, and so I'll talk about that. And for men students who have come from conventional homes, this is very strange to be looking at a man who knows a lot of recipes. And that's an example to them of something that they can be, but it doesn't compel them to. I don't share recipes with them unless they ask. I don't give them recipes or anything like that. But it's an example of something that they can think about if they want to. That didn't come about really by choice. It happened that one year I was writing my dissertation and Barb was working, and she ended up working later than I could stand. I was just too hungry by the time she got home. And so she, in the course of that year, compelled me essentially for my own starvation to learn how to cook. And ever since then, I've been the main cook in the family. But the cultural patterns like that, or actually I ask students to sort of, if you want to know what the